This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
Joseph Smith's life, of course, was one complication after another. One of the things that ended up being quite complicated for him was the trip that he took to Washington, D.C., in the late fall of 1839.
That's next on the Joseph Smith Papers.
The Mormon Channel presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
KJAZ Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
In this episode of the Joseph Smith Papers, Joseph travels to Washington, D.C. to meet with the highest officers of the United States government. The motivation for this journey came from a revelation that he received in December of 1833 after the Saints were driven out of Jackson County. The Mormons were an oppressed people, and they were seeking their rights.
James B. Allen.
Joseph believed that this was a land of liberty, and for his people not to be able to go back to Missouri or go back to Jackson County simply didn't give them the liberty that he thought the Constitution guaranteed them. Their constitutional rights, in his mind, were not being enforced. The revelation told them that the Constitution was there to protect them. It says this, "And again I say unto you, those who have been scattered by their enemies, it is my will that they should continue to importune for redress and redemption by the hands of those who are placed as rulers and are in authority over you, according to the laws and constitution of this people, which I have suffered to be established and should be maintained for the rights and protection of all flesh, according to just and holy principles, that every man may act in doctrine and principle pertaining to futurity according to the moral agency which I have given unto him." Beautiful principles announced in that revelation. "That every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. Therefore, it is not right that any man should be in bondage one to another, and for this purpose I have established the constitution of this land by the hands of wise men whom I raised up unto this very purpose." Then skipping now and going down to verse 85 of the Doctrine and Covenants, 85 through 89 of section 101. "Thus I will liken the children of Zion. Let them importune at the feet of the judge. And if he heed them not, let them importune at the feet of the governor. And if the governor heed them not, let them importune at the feet of the president. And if the president heed them not, then will the Lord arise and come forth out of his hiding place and in his fury vex the nation."
From 1833 through 1838, Joseph and the Saints worked through official channels, the judges and elected officials, trying to get their Jackson County lands back. Well, not only did the state officials not help them, but in 1838 and 39, they multiplied the offenses when they drove the Mormons from the state via the extermination order.
Jeffrey G. Cannon.
So, of course, in 1838, we've got Joseph Smith in Liberty Jail, and he's continuing to write instructions. He's continuing to tell the Saints that what they need to be doing is preparing these documents to receive redress for the persecution and for the privations that they've suffered in Missouri.
David J. Whitaker.
I read a few verses from section 123, beginning with verse 4. "And perhaps a committee can be appointed to find out these things," that is, the losses and their persecutions in Missouri, "and to take statements and affidavits, and also gather up the libelous publications that are afloat, and all that are in magazines and encyclopedias, and all the libelous histories that are published and are writing, and by whom in the presence the whole cantation of diabolical rascality and nefarious and murderous impositions that have been practiced upon this people." Joseph is a little upset and wants what they've gone through documented. Verse 6, "that we may not only publish all, to all the world, but present them to the heads of government in all their dark and hellish hue." They had attempted to get petitions for redress for their losses earlier, but now Joseph will come out of Liberty Jail focusing not just on state redress petitions, but they'll now look more at the federal levels.
And this is, I think, one of the most important parts. He says, as the last effort, which is enjoined on us by our Heavenly Father, before we can fully, completely claim that promise, which shall call him forth from his hiding place, and also that the whole nation may be left without excuse before he can send forth the power of his mighty arm.
Joseph believed that the constitutional rights of the saints had been egregiously violated. And since no state official had been willing to help them, he determined to go to the highest officers in the land with incontrovertible persuasive proof of their losses and of their suffering.
In this letter, on March 25, 1839, he extolled the Constitution. He called it a glorious standard, a heavenly banner. And he lamented the fact that the Mormons were being deprived of the blessings that it had promised, or at least in his mind, that it had promised. But at the same time, he was planning what you might call a new assault on the nation's capital, a propaganda assault. He was planning to either go himself or send somebody to Washington, D.C., to try to bring before Congress and the president the real situation of the saints. But in the crusade that he was planning, he was going to try to get financial remuneration. He had finally given up on asking the federal government to send federal troops into Missouri, but he wanted to get financial remuneration, and they were going to ask for $2 million from the federal government to compensate them for their losses in Missouri. Well, beginning in 1839 then, Joseph Smith had hundreds of affidavits sworn out before justices of the peace in Illinois about what had been happening in Missouri. And he took those with him to Washington, D.C., asking, as I said, for $2 million help pay for those losses.
Initially, Sidney Rigdon was appointed to bear the saints' petition to Washington, D.C., but by the October 1839 Conference of the Church held in Commerce, he hadn't left. So besides himself, former Caldwell County Judge Elias Higbee was appointed to join the delegation by the High Council, as was Joseph himself.
We find, though, that by the end of 1839, by the October Conference of 1839, Sidney's still in Nauvoo. He hasn't left yet. And so I think there's, to a point, the brethren that are there, the church is frustrated by Sidney Rigdon, by his lack of action, and Joseph Smith is then appointed by the conference to go with Sidney and Elias Higbee, who is a judge.
Ronald O. Barney.
He has barely time to take a deep breath. And all of that period of time between his release from Missouri and his eventual trek to Washington was complicated with the settlement and movement of the Latter-day Saints to Commerce, Illinois, that, of course, later became Nauvoo.
By late October 1839, Joseph and his companions left Commerce for Washington, D.C.
There was no contemporary record kept by Joseph Smith. I think there was an intention later on that one of his co-travelers, Robert Foster, keep a history. That just simply did not happen. So one of the primary sources we have for the trip, for what happened, the negotiations with government officials in Washington, comes from letters that are written by Joseph's traveling companion, Elias Higbee. They are all important to our understanding of this. They are contemporary. We have copies of those letters. They are something upon which we rely.
By the time, though, that they get a little farther down the road, we start getting mentions in the record of Sidney Rigdon's illness. And this becomes a theme throughout the trip, that Sidney becomes ill, then he recovers a little bit, and he's able to go on. And throughout the trip to Washington, while they're in Washington on the way back, we deal with Sidney Rigdon's illness. And as a consequence of the illness, when the company is partway through Illinois, they meet up with Robert Foster, who is a physician, and Foster agrees to come along to minister to Sidney Rigdon's health.
Once they leave Springfield and begin to move eastward, they finally hook up, in all likelihood,
with what we call the National Road. It was the main east-west thoroughfare in the United States. After leaving Illinois in late 1839, it took them almost a month to get to Washington, D.C.
They arrived in Washington on the 28th of November, 1839. And with letters of introduction in hand, they prepared to meet the President of the United States the next day.
Now, at this point, Joseph probably felt somewhat friendly toward President Martin Van Buren. He had voted for him in 1836 when he ran for president to replace Andrew Jackson. And Joseph Smith felt that Andrew Jackson was probably one of the greatest presidents the United States had ever had. He praises him very, very highly in his own political platform. So he was expecting at least to be treated nicely and politely by Martin Van Buren.
This is a very important event to the Latter-day Saints. It wasn't even a shoulder shrug of national consequence. I've read a half a dozen biographies of Martin Van Buren, and Mormons aren't even mentioned. Joseph Smith in the event is not even mentioned. It wasn't a big deal to Americans at the time. The evidence suggests they went to the congressman from Illinois, John Reynolds. And John Reynolds wrote a memoir in 1855 wherein he gives some detail to the event. There had been a lot of sympathy evoked regarding the Latter-day Saints in the aftermath of the difficulties in Missouri. He goes on, "It fell to my lot to introduce him to the president. And one morning, which was the next morning, November the 29th, one morning, Smith, the prophet, and I called at the White House to see the chief magistrate. When we were about to enter the apartment of Mr. Van Buren, the prophet asked me to introduce him as a Latter-day Saint. It was so unexpected and so strange to me, the Latter-day Saints, that I could scarcely believe he would urge such nonsense on this occasion to the president. But he repeated the request. When I asked him if I understood him correctly, I introduced him as a Latter-day Saint, which made the president smile." I think Joseph was trying to represent himself as just one of his people, was not going in as some heralded leader of people who should be treated with the kind of regal treatment that perhaps some would expect. So with this entree, Joseph Smith goes to meet with President Van Buren.
In 1839, Martin Van Buren was 57 years old and a widower. He was considered a gracious and a refined man with 18 years of experience in government. He was also a Democrat and an avowed states' rights advocate.
And there's one word that just stands out in my mind that represents Martin Van Buren was the word cautious. Martin Van Buren was not an ideologue. He was not driven by ideology, by principles, and I'm not saying that in a negative way. Right. The thing that really characterized Martin Van Buren and something that he became noted for, sometimes considered the founder of the Democratic Party, of political parties in America, a little bit as we know them today, was he was a party man.
We're indebted to Judge Elias Higbee for what happened in that first meeting with President Van Buren. It seems that within the week, he wrote a letter to Hiram Smith back in Commerce detailing the events.
"On Friday morning, the 29th of November, 1839, we proceeded to the house of the president. We found a very large and splendid palace surrounded with a splendid enclosure, decorated with all the fineries and elegancies of the world. We went to the door and requested to see the president. We were immediately introduced into an upper apartment where we met the president and were introduced into his parlor where we presented him with our letters of introduction. As soon as he had read one of them, he looked upon us with a kind of half frown and said, 'What can I do? I can do nothing for you. If I do anything, I shall come in contact with the whole state of Missouri. Well, that's become famous. Mm-hmm. That becomes the summary of their experience together. But, Elias Higbee says, but we were not to be intimidated and demanded a hearing and constitutional rights. Before we left him, he promised to reconsider what he had said and observed that he felt to sympathize with us on account of our sufferings. Elias Higbee also included this passage. In our interview with the president, he interrogated us whether we differed in our religion from the other religions of the day. And I find that interesting. We deemed it unnecessary to make many words in preaching the gospel to him. Suffice it to say, he has got our testimony. Joseph Smith comes in still a very young man. He's in his early 30s. Martin Van Buren was born in 1782. Oh, yeah. He has some experience under his belt. Joseph was known to look younger than what he was. Martin Van Buren may have been kind of underwhelmed with Joseph. Besides recognizing right off the bat, I'm not going to do anything with these people because it would take me way outside the way that I've carried on my administration thus far.
Martin Van Buren believed that the United States Constitution did not allow for the federal government to interfere in the affairs of the states. It was in that interpretation of the Constitution that he and Joseph Smith radically differed.
Jeffrey G. Cannon.
Martin Van Buren was only doing what he said he would do. This is a case of a politician actually following through on his campaign promises, that he was a states' rights Democrat. He did not read the Constitution as giving him power to send anybody, any troops into Missouri to take care of this problem, that this was Missouri's problem to be handled within Missouri, and that the federal government, the way that he read the Constitution, had no business interfering.
Well, then Joseph began to circulate the halls of Congress. He would buttonhole congressmen. He was kind of a lobbyist, to be honest, as he went from one congressman to another, and to members of both the Senate and the House of Representatives.
With no success, Joseph left Washington and traveled to Pennsylvania and New Jersey, visiting branches of the Saints. By the end of January, though, he returned to Washington and presented a memorial to Congress outlining the grievances of the saints.
The signature on it is the date of the 27th of January. It's presented in Congress on the 28th. It's presented on the Senate floor. And it's debated somewhat, sent to committee, and pretty much dies.
President Van Buren had reconsidered his earlier position, but hadn't changed his position. And according to Joseph Smith, he said he treated us very insolently and listened to his arguments only with reluctance. Gentlemen, the president said, your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you, he finally said. If I take up for you, I shall lose the vote of Missouri.
Joseph leaves, and Elias Higbee is left in Washington to take care of the situation, to represent the church, but eventually Elias Higbee fails as well. Mm. And the memorial goes basically unanswered.
Joseph Smith went away from Washington, D.C., underwhelmed.
Interesting.
First of all, Washington, D.C. was certainly no European capital. Mm-hmm. In the 1830s, even till the late 1830s, Washington, D.C. was described very critically as a place where there's no buildings. It's just wide expanse. The only macadamized or kind of paved road was Pennsylvania Avenue. And the two primary buildings at that time were the White House and the National Capitol. Mm-hmm. It was looked upon as being kind of a backwater area.
Your cause is just, Van Buren said, but I can do nothing for you.
James B. Allen.
And that's all we Mormons tend to remember sometimes. And it is true that he was politically concerned. But I think he was also concerned. I think sometimes we don't give him enough credit to also being a man of integrity when it comes to his own long-held positions about states' rights. We've had a long history of kind of vilifying Martin Van Buren, and I think he probably was weak. He probably could have made an effort, but he probably had these other things going through his mind too, and I don't think he was being dishonest or evil or some of the other things that we sometimes accuse him of. Even providing financial aid for them would have been considered by some as a constitutional violation, for that would mean that the federal government had taken an official cognizance of an issue between citizens of one state now, Illinois, and the citizens of another state.
Joseph did not agree with Van Buren's reading of the United States Constitution. To him, the taking of the saints' lives, liberty, and property did a far greater injustice to the document.
He made up his mind that he couldn't consciously support Van Buren again. Van Buren was up for re-election that year, and he said, "I will not support him as the head of our noble republic." Then, according to his history, "On my way home, I did not fail to proclaim the iniquity and insolence of Martin Van Buren toward myself and an injured people, and may he never be elected again to any office of trust or power by which he may abuse the innocent. Let the guilty go free."
When Joseph returned to Nauvoo after his departure from Illinois, and he arrived, or after his departure from Washington, and he arrived in Illinois the first week of March of 1840, he began to speak about his experiences and especially his disappointment in the reception that he received from Martin Van Buren.
When Joseph returned to Illinois, his experiences in Washington began to attract the attention of some newspapers. A reporter from the New York Journal of Commerce described in March of 1840 hearing Joseph speak about his trip.
He said on his arrival at Washington, he, with two of his elders, Rigdon and Higbee, called on Mr. Van Buren at the White House with a letter of introduction. And after making known to him the subject of their visit and soliciting him to help them, Mr. Van Buren replied, "Help you? How can I help you? All Missouri would turn against me." But they demanded of Mr. Van Buren a hearing, and he, after listening a few moments to their tale of injured innocence, abruptly left the room. After waiting some time for his return, they were under the necessity of departing, disappointed and chagrined. Now that's an angle we haven't heard about the visit. He thought Mr. Van Buren treated them with great disrespect and neglect, which would help explain this feeling of disappointment and outrage at the way the chief executive of the country had treated them.
Another reporter, this one from the Alexandria, Virginia Gazette, interviewed Joseph around this same time, also about his trip to Washington.
"Before he had heard the story of our wrongs," said the indignant prophet, "Mr. Van Buren gave us to understand that he could do nothing for the redress of our grievances, lest it should interfere with his political prospects in Missouri." Then this is underscored. "He is not as fit," said he. This is Joseph speaking about the president. "He is not as fit," said he, "as my dog for the chair of state. For my dog will make an effort to protect his abused and insulted master, while the present chief magistrate will not so much as lift his finger to relieve an oppressed and persecuted community of freemen, whose glory it has been that they were citizens of the United States."
Joseph and the saints don't give up. Throughout the rest of Joseph's life, they continue to send memorials and petitions to Congress asking for help. And while their importunate cries seem to arouse no sympathies in Washington, they do arouse the attention of some notables in Illinois.
Ronald O. Barney.
One of the things that's an interesting aftermath of this is that once Joseph Smith gets back, once word gets out about the way the Latter-day Saints have been maligned, an interesting character comes along and begins writing in defense of the Latter-day Saints, argues the outrages that were laid upon them, and by and by he works his way into the favor of the church, John C. Bennett.
Right.
And he becomes an advocate for the saints in Illinois newspapers, saying these people have not been treated well. And so John C. Bennett comes into Mormon influence, and then comes into the to influence the Mormons on the heels of this grave disappointment in Washington, D.C.
In spite of this whole experience, Joseph never lost faith in the law, in America, or the Constitution, even though in some respects he was a man far ahead of his time.
He began to criticize the states' rights doctrine very openly, and he called for some kind of constitutional amendment that would clearly put more power in the hands of the national government. In 1843, on October 15th, he gave a sermon on the Constitution. He said, "I am the greatest advocate of the Constitution of the United States there is on earth. In my feelings, I am always ready to die for the protection of the weak and oppressed in their just rights. The only fault I find with the Constitution is it is not broad enough to cover the whole ground. Although it provides that all men shall enjoy religious freedom, yet it does not provide the manner by which that freedom can be preserved, nor for the punishment of government officers who refuse to protect the people and their rights. Its sentiments are good, but it provides no means of enforcing them. It has but this one fault." Then he said, "The Constitution should contain a provision that every officer of the government who should neglect or refuse to extend the protection guaranteed in the Constitution should be subject to capital punishment. And then the President of the United States would not say, 'Your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you.'" Actually, what he was doing was anticipating some parts of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which wasn't passed until 1868.
Joseph Smith never gave up advocating the rights of the oppressed. As the presidential election of 1844 approached, Joseph corresponded with the leading candidates to sound them out, if you will. His constitutional views were rejected.
Well, that leads really to Joseph Smith finally making a decision to run for president of the United States.
When we return, what would it have been like to sit at the feet of Joseph Smith and hear him teach? Next week, the Sermons of Joseph Smith. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel.